This is Chatter. I'm Shane Harris. This week, historian Joseph Thompson on the surprising alliance between the Pentagon and the country music industry.
U.S. soldiers are essentially captive audiences waiting for entertainment, and they'll take basically whatever you give them. There are personal connections between people in the country music industry and the military, right? So either they start out in country music and go to the military and come back out, or they start in the military and then once they get into civilian life, find their way into the country music industry in one way or another. There's a real sense that they are doing their duty and just providing good entertainment. If we think about, well, if we want to break open country music and really make it a more diverse space, part of the thing that I think we have to do is understand how it came to be understood as a white space to begin with. And I hope that my book is telling part of that story that hasn't been fully explored yet.
Joseph Thompson, welcome to Chatter. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Shane. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, this is fitting that we're on a podcast because so much of what we're going to be talking about is the things that were on the radio and music. You are the author of the new book, Cold War Country, How Nashville's Music Row and the Pentagon Created the Sound of American Patriotism. And I have to admit, when I saw the title of this book, I was excited, not because I'm a particular fan of country music, although I've grown up around a lot of it, as maybe we'll get into in the discussion. But the title just immediately made sense to me because I so identify as somebody who's written about national security for 25 years and am fascinated by the history of the Cold War, of how country music is so associated with the military and the Defense Department and ideas around patriotism. So I was really excited to read your book, which I enjoyed. And we'll get into all of it, but I want to just start by talking about you a little bit. Tell us kind of where you're from and what you do. You're a professor of history. And then how you came to want to write about the history of country music through this lens.
Yeah, so I teach history, United States history at Mississippi State University in Starkville, Mississippi. I had a kind of rambling journey into academia. I never really expected so much to end up where I did. I have a very, in terms of my just academic training, I have a very interdisciplinary background. I got my undergraduate degree at the University of Alabama in anthropology and American studies, two disciplines that are, you know, very much embrace interdisciplinarity. And so I've always approached the past by thinking about connections between different ways of thinking, different sectors of life, whether that's, you know, politics and consumerism and music. Obviously, all of that comes into play into my book. I kind of began to refine my interest in the academic world through a master's program at the University of Mississippi called Southern Studies, another interdisciplinary program. And there I wrote about the lost cause in music, which kind of gave me a little foothold into thinking about connections between political culture, ideologies of race and patriotism and expressions of music. And then my PhD at the University of Virginia only refined that further and led me into this path. That's the academic side of things. The personal side of things is that I grew up in a very small town in North Alabama that's not far from Huntsville. And many of the people that I grew up around worked in Huntsville. Many of them worked in the defense sector in one way or another, often on Redstone Arsenal or as engineers working for the space programs or defense contractors in Huntsville. And I saw how much our region depended on that infusion of federal money, right? And at the same time, I grew up in the 80s and 90s at a time when the kind of political discourse at a local level and a national level was kind of trending towards conservatism and a particular kind of conservatism that said, you know, big government is bad. This is the enemy of the people, right? And I heard that not in my household, but with people that I grew up around, right? So it's always been a kind of fascinating paradox to me about when people accept the role of government in their life and when they don't, right? And where they divide those lines. And this is not to call out some kind of, you know, false consciousness that people might have or what have you, but just a sense of what makes people tick in this way, right? What leads them down this particular political road? How does that have an effect on culture? I am a cultural historian by training through my interdisciplinary programs and through my degree at UVA. And music was always a thing that fascinated me in a personal level too. And so when I began thinking about this topic, I wanted to think about, okay, I have this political question, right? This paradox that I just laid out. But I'm a cultural historian, so I use those tools to answer a political question. It's a kind of roundabout way into getting into this topic and trying to answer this political question is saying, okay, yes, there's this disproportionate impact of defense spending on the U.S. South. Surely that has a cultural impact. So then how can we use music to figure that out?
And did you grow up around country music, or were you a fan of it growing up?
I definitely grew up around it. My grandparents were big listeners to country music, and they lived just across the state line. I grew up right on the Alabama-Tennessee line, and they lived in Tennessee and would go to fanfare every year in Nashville, which is this big celebration where country music fans can meet the stars and get autographs and this kind of thing. So they would go to fanfare. Twitty City, Conway Twitty's tourist destination. And so I definitely grew up around that. As young people often do, they sort of reject the culture of their elders, right? And so I definitely grew up in a time where I thought country music was, I heard it all the time. I was inundated by it. And so it was the thing that I rejected for a long time, right? As I got into high school and college years, I came around to it and thought, oh, this is actually something really cool and something to celebrate about the regional history of the U.S. South in particular. And I kind of came at it through like bluegrass and I was in college during the alt country scare of the late 90s. And so I definitely got into country music that way and gradually just came to accept a lot of it and now listen to it pretty regularly. Yeah.
Yeah. I suspect we're probably roughly the same age. I grew up I was born in Oregon, but when I was nine, my family moved to Nashville.
Okay.
So I had grown up kind of listening to what we would have thought of as like country Western a little bit.
Sure.
And then we moved to Nashville, and it's like, that's why I'm kind of nodding along. Your listeners can't see it when you're mentioning things like Twitty City and fanfare and all that. This was very much sort of like what I grew up around as a kid, even though we were all transplants to the South. So a lot of your book resonated with me for that reason. But let's get into the story about really how this kind of alliance forms between country music as an industry, particularly with, you know, the military, with the Pentagon. Your book starts out with someone who is a fascinating character that I suspect probably most listeners will have never heard of, even if they know a lot about country music. It's a man named Connie Gay. Tell us about who he was and, you know, kind of the foundational role that he plays in the story that you're telling.
Yeah. Connie B. Gay. He really is a foundational figure in country music history in terms of, particularly in terms of the foundation of the industry. And as you suggest, he's kind of the linchpin in my story about how we really get this, these institutional connections between, what becomes known as Music Row, this kind of catch-all term for the Nashville industry, and the Defense Department. And he's kind of a typical new dealer in the 1930s and 40s. He's born into poverty and in North Carolina, a small town called Lizard Lick, North Carolina. It's too good not to say on
so
air.
Good.
Yeah.
So good.
and kind of grew up in poverty and looked for ways to escape that poverty. He gets on a agricultural education route at North Carolina State, and from there launches into a career with the FSA, a part of the New Deal, the Farm Security Administration. And when he does that, he gets a kind of a view into the way that government can improve people's lives, and also the way that mass media and government can intersect to get particular messages to people. And the way that he does that is that as he's working for the FSA, he's promoting some of its conservation programs. And he figures out that if he gets on the radio, local radio in North Carolina, and promotes these programs, then he can spread the message of the New Deal programs in a much more efficient way through mass media. And I should say, he stays in the New Deal programs throughout the 1940s. Well, flash forward to 1946, we're after the war, right? And he has, because of his connections to the New Deal, he has landed in Washington, D.C. And in Washington, D.C., he's still working for the Farm and Home Hour and being a radio announcer for this program. And he notices that whenever the Farm and Home Hour plays, they have an orchestra that accompanies the news. Whenever that orchestra plays something with what he calls a rural flavor, it elicits a great response from the listeners, and they write in saying how much they enjoy the music. And, you know, this is a guy who had grown up hearing kind of country and string band music, what would have been called hillbilly music at the time. Mm-hmm. And so this gives him an idea about the kind of power of mass media and the way to sell particular messages through its associations with country music. And so he convinces a radio station to let him be a daytime announcer on the air. All working on commission, if they will let him play whatever type of music he wants. And this is all a sort of plan to get more quote unquote hillbilly or country and Western music on the air in the Washington, D.C. area. And when he does so, it sort of causes a minor revolution in people's listening patterns in the Washington, D.C. area. You got to remember, this is a time in which, because of the war and because of the New Deal programs before it, this is a time in which people are flocking to Washington, D.C., from Virginia, from the rural parts of Maryland, from North Carolina, like Connie Gay. And so you've got these rural to urban transplants who are now hearing this music that they have grown up listening to. And it's really a reflection of both their commercial and folk cultures. And so now someone is kind of clued into the idea that, hey, we can sell a lot of advertisement, which is what radio is, right? Selling advertisements. We can sell a lot of advertisements and make a lot of money if we can put this kind of music on the air. And so that kind of launches his radio career. From there, he becomes a sort of country music impresario, and he begins booking concerts around Washington, D.C., controversially, including Constitution Hall in 1948, mm-hmm. which was it caused a bit of a stir amongst the Daughters of the American Revolution there for, sullying the staid confines of their hall there.
Is that because a hillbilly was doing the show?
Yeah. Exactly. Because, there was this kind of connotation that with hillbillies comes, raucousness and, this uncouth behavior, and they're probably drinking moonshine and have mud on their shoes, right? This was the idea anyways, right?
Like the Jackson administration, yeah.
So in a way to sort of get around this connotation of being hillbillies, he calls his concerts at Constitution Hall folk music concerts. Mm-hmm. And so in this way, he can sort of, elevate the class status of country music. And this is key to his, this is really key to his strategy all along, is elevating the class status. In fact, he books a yacht that cruises up and down the Potomac, in which he books country bands on. And so you can imagine the kind of juxtaposition of this yacht going up and down the Potomac past Arlington and all this with these, country music bands playing on it. So, in 1951, Connie Gay who is kind of on and off manages a musician that many listeners will probably be familiar with, a guy named Grandpa Jones, Lewis mm-hmm. Marshall Jones. People will probably remember him from reruns of Hee Haw or the Grand Ole Opry. And so in 1951, Connie B. Gay books Grandpa Jones and his band called The Grandchildren, or His Grandchildren, which is actually his wife and another woman, oddly enough. Connie Gay books Grandpa Jones and His Grandchildren on a tour of Japan and South Korea, now during the Korean War. And when he does this, he's able to really promote Grandpa Jones and himself, and this is key, and promote his radio stations back in the Washington, D.C. area as particularly and especially patriotic, right, for fulfilling this kind of duty. And when he does this, he realizes that that U.S. soldiers are essentially captive audiences waiting for entertainment, and they'll take basically whatever you give them. And so if his business is country music, he's going to give them as much country music as possible. And so this starts Gay's career in terms of booking country music artists in military installations around the world, Europe, Asia, the Caribbean, etc. That's one way that he connects to this military story. The other way is that he is a pioneer in creating country music radio recruitment programs. He actually essentially helps record some of the very first country music recruitment programs. And so you would get a sort of, you would get a few songs from a country music artist, and then Connie Gay would come on and tell you about how to join the military and the benefits of that, the U.S. Army, what that can do for you, and then you would hear some more country music programs. And this becomes sort of the template for radio recruitment for country music that's going to carry on into the 1980s, actually.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, well, one thing I found fascinating about his story was that it's sort of like the birth of country music as a popular industry starts in Washington, D.C. on the airwaves here near where I live, which I had no idea about. But what it seems like when you write, one of the keys to his success was that he was able to really signal to his listeners, you know, that he understood where they were coming from, a real connection, particularly to white Southerners, or like what we would think of as kind of country folk, and to connect them to their loved ones that were serving overseas, which seems like that made him also very authentic with the service personnel that he was kind of catering to. Did he have a sense that, I mean, you talk about them, people in the military being a captive audience, did he kind of intuitively know that, or did he figure that out as he starts booking acts and going around and the show is getting more popular?
Yeah, I think he figures that out essentially on that that tour with Grandpa Jones in 1951. Now, this wasn't anything new to the entertainment industry, right? Yeah. I mean, we go back to World War One, and especially World War Two with the USO tours. And in fact, he's not the first one to have a country music tour of the military, right? Members of the Grand Ole Opry, particularly Roy Acuff, were doing this back in the 1940s. So this is not a new idea about we can entertain the troops. But what's interesting for Connie Gay and why he is central to my story is that he really sees the kind of commercial potential of this. Right. If you can turn people into consumers of country music. Right. And so in this way, he's kind of connecting those international audiences with his domestic audiences in ways that you referenced. Right. When he goes to Korea, for instance, he's interviewing soldiers from the Washington, D.C. area, from Maryland and Delaware and Northern Virginia. And then kind of using that as a way to say, hey, and you know, tell your folks back home that WARL was here and broadcasting and they came to see you, right? And in this way, he really kind of sells himself as doing his patriotic duty and braving the front lines of Korea, which is true. Like Grandpa Jones is out there really getting close to the troops in ways that a lot of other entertainers couldn't do. More famous entertainers, and particularly entertainers who may have, you know, required a piano or had a large entourage, right? You've got Grandpa Jones out there with his banjo, and Ramona Jones, his wife, and Mary Click, their accompanist, they're all out there and they can travel really well. So this is an interesting thing that occurred to me writing the book, is that country music, the instrumentation of country music actually makes it more portable, and it's acoustic. They can go to these places and get into the kind of intimate lives with these soldiers, even close to the front line.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And it's that kind of music would have been music that people gathered around to play and to listen to and to hear, as a lot of music is. But there's an intimacy to this style that I think is at its roots. There's another character that comes into the story when we're talking about military recruitment, named Farron Young. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, so Farron Young, for country music fans, will be a familiar name. He's a Hall of Fame member. He was one of the biggest stars of the 1960s for sure. Well, really beginning in the 50s and into the 60s. He's the first one to record Hello Walls, written by Willie Nelson, for instance. So Farron Young, he's from Shreveport, Louisiana. He is a kind of struggling, up-and-coming country singer in the early 1950s. He begins recording in 1952 or so, begins to have some success by playing on the Louisiana Hayride, and then gets kind of a promotion, so to speak, to the Grand Ole Opry. This is all in late 1952. And at the same time, in November of 1952, he gets his draft notice. And this is devastating for the young Farron Young, because he's just now getting his career off the ground, and he realizes he's going to have to leave his civilian life and enter the Army. Well, as he's training in South Carolina, one of his early recordings, called Going Steady, breaks onto the charts in January 1953, and he's got a hit on his hands. Well, this is actually convenient for the Army in a way, because they realize that they have drafted this up-and-coming star, country music star, and perhaps they can use him in some way. Now, at the time, the main voice in terms of music, the main voice of Army recruitment was Eddie Fisher, a pop star who kind of harkened back to, a kind of crooner, Sinatra, swing-type era. But now we've got this new sound breaking with Going Steady and Farron Young. And if people don't know the song, I'd urge you to check it out. It sounds an awful, awful lot like Hank Williams, which was a key to success, because Hank had just died. Hank and Farron Young and Hank were associates in a way. And in fact, it sounds so much like Hank Williams that they accused Farron Young of plagiarism with that song. But anyhow, so this song is hitting. And one of the ways that the Army is trying to recruit people at this time is through television shows that can highlight the talents of service members. There's one hosted by Steve Allen called Talent Patrol. And so the idea, you can imagine a sort of Arthur Godfrey, if you know what that is, or even a kind of almost like American Idol, where there's a sort of competition to show off the so-called amateur talent that is making up our Cold War military in the 1950s here. And so the Army puts Farron Young on that show, and lo and behold, he wins. And because it turns out he's not really that much of an amateur. He's kind of a ringer in this way. He's been honing his skills for quite a while at that point, and has a hit record. And because of that, and he's able to win this and sort of get this national exposure through Talent Patrol, the Army starts putting him on these radio recruitment shows that Connie B. Gay has started in the Washington, D.C. area. Not only that, they put him on the road entertaining troops around the South. They relocate him to Fort McPherson in Atlanta as kind of his home base. They give his band these new uniforms and I love this detail, right? On the new uniforms, there's an A with a circle around it as the patch, right? Well, that's the insignia for the 3rd U.S. Army, which was what Farron Young was a part of. But Farron Young calls his band, or the Army calls his band, the Circle A Wranglers, right? Which sounds like a ranch or something, like a cattle brand, but it's actually a reference to their Army insignia there. So he's able to kind of go around the Southeast playing for all these troops. He gets to go back onto the Opry, which he performs his songs, and at the same time says, you know, this message, you know, my performance is brought to you by the 3rd U.S. Army. So it's a way in which he is able to sort of, the Defense Department and the Army acts as a sort of promotional arm for the country music industry, and in particular, Farron Young at this point. So that's the connection for Farron Young. And it's one thing if it was just me, a historian, saying I've interpreted this way, but there's actually an interview with Farron Young in the 1980s in which he says, you know, people don't understand that the Army is what launched my career. So it's like, when I found that, I was like, thank you, Farron, because up until that point, I felt like, you know, I'm uncovering this story, but is it true? Right. And then you have the person say, yes, in fact, this is true. So.
Yeah. And so it's clearly, you know, as you say, the military realizes if they've got a hit on their hands insofar mm-hmm. as very well known, very talented, up and coming young guy who's singing. It's the music is appealing to people. But what was it about, do you think, country music in particular that made it so appealing as a recruitment tool? Because as you pointed out, you know, Eddie Fisher and others kind of more maybe like in, you know, the crooner style, or we can like even Glenn Miller and the sort of the big band era. Sure. And so the military has embraced different genres of music and kind of put them forward and identify mm-hmm. with them. So why did country appeal for getting people to want to join the Army?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I, you know, for all my focus on country music, and there's, you know, 250 something pages of focusing on country music in this book, I don't mean to say that it's the only genre of music being used in these recruitment and entertainment programs. It's certainly not. And I make reference throughout the book to these other forms of music. But I think country music has such a lasting relationship with the military, and is able to really kind of plant a flag, so to speak, with a relationship to the military in the 1950s because of the political climate of the time in the 1950s, right? And country music is selling itself as a reflection of American heritage, as a reflection of American roots, which, you know, is in part true. Right. It's not to say that it's any more American than any other genre, right. But they were able to spin it at the time to say that, you know, we are the modern reflection of these like pioneers who kind of traverse the Appalachians with their banjos on their back. Right. Mm-hmm. And so there's this kind of American exceptionalism story that's being told, particularly through politicians who are connected to the country music industry, who like to sell country music and themselves and the state of Tennessee as kind of emblematic of America at a time at which that really resonates with people.
Yeah, and it's something that carries through in so much of the how I think about, certainly, and clearly you do too, about country music and its associations with, you know, patriotism, service, but also, you know, a kind of a working class, right? Of mm-hmm. America, and it kind of, as you said, a frontier kind of aspect. And it seems like there too, the military is realizing that is a very rich source of recruits, right? People who maybe they don't go to college, they're not joining. So that's kind of, they're pulling from it. And the singers are signaling to people who are listening, we're one of you, we come from, you know, your place. There's a line in the book that I'll just read people to give people a flavor, where I think this is on one of Connie Gay's shows, where he's talking to people after having visited Korea, and he reports back, our boys are doing a magnificent job. They're killing more Chinese than Carter's has liver pills, referring to, you know, a reference they will totally get, referring to, you know, the store and the medicine. So right. It's all about knowing the audience, it seems to me.
That's right. And it's, you know, I think of country music as sort of giving a kind of populist down-home cover to the U.S. military at a time in which it's building up, right? We're in the midst, we're post NSC 68. We're in the kind of arms race, beginning of the arms race here in a way. And so how do you make people comfortable with this new, this newly robust, quote unquote, peacetime military. And one way to do that, inadvertently or not, one way that it's done is through country music. And I say inadvertently or not because I don't want to give the impression that there are guys sitting around in the Pentagon twirling their mustaches and saying, how are we going to get these hillbillies into the army, you know? But they are studying their demographics, and they do see that there is a sort of pipeline of recruits who and enlistees who come from the U.S. South. And if they want to keep that pipeline coming, then perhaps they should create these programs that keeps the tap flowing, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, you write a lot about Farron Young as the kind of the face of military recruitment. There, of course, is another music figure that everybody will associate with the face of music recruitment when he gets drafted. And that, of course, is Elvis. And you spend a lot of time in the book talking about like him when he is drafted and the sort of the national crisis, I suppose, this ensues for his fans. One of the things that I found so interesting is you write that at first it seems like the military is not sure that they want Elvis as a poster boy for recruitment because he's so appealing mainly to young girls and not to young men.
Talk right. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I actually tried to write this without Elvis at first, and I was told that was a terrible idea. And I
definitely help your sales. Yeah.
Yeah. I agree that he belongs in there. And he belongs in there in perhaps kind of surprising ways to people because I really position Elvis as someone who's embedded in the country music industry, which he was. We think of him as the king of rock and roll or whatever. And that's all true, but not yet in my story, right? Yeah, I'm talking about young Elvis kind of figuring out his way in the world. He's a part of the junior ROTC at Humes High School in Memphis. He actually works for a company that has a defense contract in the summertime during the Korean War while he's still in high school. So he's really kind of a reflection of the way defense spending made and remade the Southern political economy and the options for employment for a young man like him at the time. And so, then he's kind of derailed from a career that would have taken him down a defense employment because he becomes the biggest star in the world. and not overnight, but almost, right?
Almost.
And so he's very much this kind of symbol of adolescent rebellion, as we all probably know. And he's also a symbol of this kind of threat to the country music industry. They don't quite know what to do with him. They want his sales, of course. They want his popularity. There's even a trend where older stars sort of adopt some of the musical styles and particularly the songs that Elvis is recording, right? And that's all well and good, except, you know, he obviously represents this embrace of Black culture that makes much of Nashville uneasy at this time. And so they don't know quite what to do with him. And obviously, as you suggest, he's very popular with young women. So this overlap between this rebelliousness, this kind of racial and gender play that he's performing, and his popularity with young women, the U.S. Army takes a look at him and says, well, this is not who we need for recruitment. Mm-hmm. This is not who we need even for special services as an entertainer. Right. Which is something that Eddie Fisher did and Farron Young. So we don't really want anything to do with him. Now he's going to have to serve because his number is up and we're not going to coddle the pop music stars of the day and give them any special treatment. And Elvis is able to sort of use this to his advantage, right? When he does have to report for duty in 1958, he is devastated, as you might expect, right? And the Army still is like, no, we don't want anything to do with him. All these reports that you're hearing that he's going to be the face of recruitment or he's going to be the face of entertainment, all bogus, right? He's going to go quietly and serve. And that's exactly what he does. You essentially don't hear from Elvis or see him very much until 2 years later in 1960 and when this kind of transformation has happened. Now, this idea that the Army transformed Elvis is not new by any means. I mean, everyone that's written about Elvis has written about this. often in a sort of kind of declension sort of way, right? Like this was the beginning of the end for Elvis because his rebelliousness is sort of neutered. And you know, this was kind of this extraordinary thing that happened to him. And I want to say, and my kind of argument against that is that it's not extraordinary at all. In fact, it's very, very ordinary for a man like him, particularly someone who's coming from the working class white South, as he did. But also, if we really consider him as a country music star, then it perfectly tracks with the people who've come before him that have kind of wedded together their musical image and their military service. And so then you look at him in 1960, when he gets out, he makes the film G.I. Blues, right? Which is essentially a recruitment film, shows how kind of great the military life can be. And it's all done with the cooperation of the Defense Department. So in 2 years, not only has Elvis transformed, but the Defense Department's attitude towards Elvis has transformed. They're able to kind of welcome him into the fold in this way.
And I just found so interesting, too, that there was this conflict and this real fear within the country music industry, as you write, about Elvis as kind of, you know, a threat to their ideals. I mean, there's the kind of the threat to Southern whiteness. There's the threat to gender stereotypes mm-hmm. because he's out there with his hair poofed up and he's wearing mascara.
Right.
And, you know, but it's funny because, I mean, I'm not by any means a huge Elvis fan, but to me, I always saw him as somebody who was rooted in Southern music, particularly mm-hmm. blues, kind of had the country rockabilly thing sort of, and just sort of naturally kind of becomes more of a pop figure. And of course, in his later years, like harkens back, he's kind of doing country stuff. But sure. I was just fascinated that so many people in the industry looked at him like, God, this guy's going to ruin everything.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a way of doing things in the country music industry, and he was blowing that up at the time. Yeah. So it really felt like an internal rebellion for them. And I make the kind of analogy in the book about a similar feeling of an internal rebellion happening because of desegregation that's happening both in civilian life and in military life in the South, right? And so some of the very people who are criticizing Elvis as being this race mixer and this threat to the white supremacy in the South are also harping on the fact that the military installations that are really all over the South are also these kind of islands of integration. They see this as a threat too. So they're really kind of these white supremacists at the time are really feeling a crunch from both kind of popular culture and the federal government at the same time. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So we enter a new period in the evolution of country music at this point in the story that you tell, where country music is starting to really go global. And as you write, the armed forces and the military are a huge part of that. So talk about the influence of, you know, armed forces radio and the importance of selling records in the PX stores on bases.
Yeah. So the PX is, well, you know, before there was a thing called the PX, the post exchange, there were people who would sort of follow the army around and sell them civilian goods. And then, with the emergence of the PX, it becomes an official arm of the military. That's a way to get soldiers American goods that they are missing at home, regardless of where they're stationed. Well, in 1947, records become a part of their inventory, and so the music industry sees this from the get-go. They see this as a boom for them, right? Again, to go back to this idea as soldiers as a captive audience. Here you have people that you can sort of feed exactly what you want to sell them. And they have no other or very few options to purchase music if they want to do so. This is really going to grow over the course of the 1950s as records become more widely available and as 45s become a popular medium. So 45 RPM for those who don't know, it's just a single song.
For our younger listeners just going, what is he talking about now?
On each side, I know. Sometimes I forget. But anyhow, so this becomes really popular in the 1950s, and the record industry writ large is really looking at the military as this large consumer, perhaps the single biggest consumer of records in the United States, and that would really mean around the world too. So one way I think about the PX, and I didn't think I wrote about it in this way in the book, but the one way I think about it is that they were kind of a big box store before they were big box stores,
totally.
For records. Like, think of they were Best Buy or Camelot Music before that was a thing. And so they're sort of a chain in that way. And so if you can get your records in there, you can sell them to these service members who have no other option. This is happening at about the same time that something called the Country Music Association is being formed. It forms in 1958 as a quote-unquote chamber of commerce for country music. So they're out there to kind of police the image of country music at the time. So kind of lifting it up out of its more derogatory associations with hillbilly music, as I referenced earlier, talking about Connie Gay. And speaking of Connie Gay, who's the founding president of the Country Music Association, but our old friend from DC up there. And so Connie Gay he re-enters the story in a big way in when I get to the CMA and this kind of global aspirations for really spreading the message of country music and selling records around the world to military members. The founding slogan of the CMA is Best Liked Worldwide, which is totally aspirational at that point in the late 50s, early 60s. But if they do want to achieve that, then they're going to want to get more of their music on the radio. And as you suggested, the Armed Forces Radio is going to be a boom for them, not only because they're able to put more country music on the radio, but if they are, then those country fans or potential fans will hear those songs and have nowhere else to turn but the PX to buy the record of the song that they just heard. So in this way, they kind of click in to this pipeline of get country music on the radio, on the AFRTS, and then from there, those service members will go and buy our records in the PXs. And so there's some amazing statistics that I came across, like, you know, in 1961, supposedly because of popular demand on the European AFRTS networks, the radio service boosts the amount of country music on air by like 35%. And so when you turn on the radio, the AFRTS stations in Europe at the time, you know, more than likely at some point you're going to hear some country music that day, maybe multiple shows. Not only that we begin to see a real kind of financial payoff for the country music industry because of this. Because there's so much more country music on the air, that leads to more record sales. And so by the end of the 1960s, there's more country records being sold in the European PXs than any other genre. And that was kind of mind-blowing for me to figure out. Because, you know, when we think of the late 1960s, we're in the Vietnam era, we're thinking rock and roll, we're thinking the kind of infusion of the counterculture within even the ranks of the military. And that's certainly true. I'm not here to say that that didn't happen by any means. There were, particularly in Vietnam, countercultural music was a powerful tool for soldiers to cope with the war and to sort of have a safe rebellion against the conformity of army life. But at the same time that that's happening, there are more people buying country records, particularly in the PXs in Europe, than any other genre. And so I part of the story that I'm telling is to kind of expand and reorient the way that we think about the sound of military life in the 1960s. It's not all Creedence Clearwater and Jimi Hendrix, which is all there. I'm not saying it's not, but there's something else going on too. Yeah. And it's something that really, really benefits people like the CMA and those record producers on Music Row. So by the late 1960s, they've really wedded themselves to the military as a pipeline for getting their music on air and getting records sold.
And it doesn't even yet, the music doesn't even yet have a lot of the overt patriotism that we'll get to later in the discussion that you talk about in the book. It's still, I mean, it's country music. It's just this, that the customer base is locked in because of this very strong alliance. And there's this great anecdote that you tell that I think kind of gets at this of where we are now in the late 1960s. It's in 1968 in the Country Music Association, which is now set up and people will know now what the CMA is from awards programs and things like that. Cuts this record, this album called Country Music Salutes the Armed Forces. So tell us a little bit about the album, what made it special, and importantly, where the money from the sales of the album went.
Yeah, this was another fascinating little find for me. Yeah, so it's this compilation record that's going to be sold exclusively in the PXs, Country Music Salutes the Armed Forces. And it's a compilation record of different patriotic themed songs, some of them going back to World War II. So it's not all, they didn't just re-record or record a bunch of music right then in the moment for Vietnam. They're kind of scraping this together and then selling it to service members in the PXs, which sounds fine and good. And I suppose it is. But then the profits, and this is what you're hinting at, the profits from that will go to the fund to build the Country Music Hall of Fame and Museum, the original one on Music Row. So there's a way in which they're trying to essentially, I don't know, get as many dollars as possible from the soldiers, all while kind of couching this as we're doing something for the troops. Yeah. In return, of course, the quiet part is the troops are doing something for the country music industry as well. And this is not to suggest that there was, you know, that soldiers' dollars built the Country Music Hall of Fame. I'm not saying that at all, but I just find it interesting that they would then kind of refunnel that money back into their own pockets in that way. So it doesn't go to, say, a charity for soldiers or something like that, but instead it goes right back to them.
There's a cynicism in that particular anecdote, and it's kind of what I found myself wondering is, you know, is that a pervasive cynicism that is there throughout the industry where, you know, people in Nashville and on Music Row are saying, you know, oh, this great captive audience, just like make them buy more country records and like let's put the country stuff on air and let's lobby Washington to get behind it. Yeah. I mean, is it you think it's mostly cynical, or was there already kind of a well of patriotism in the people who were making this music and selling it that actually is quite distinct to them, and that there that this kind of was coming from a place of, yes, it's a business, but we also believe in supporting the military. We believe in promoting the ideas as we see it of a way of living as Americans.
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I really don't think that it's cynicism. I think it's, and I wouldn't even say that it's a particular or a patriotism that's particular to country music. I think it's a patriotism that is very mainstream in America in the 1950s and 60s,
yeah.
At least up into the later years of Vietnam. They would have seen nothing wrong with taking that money and putting it back into something that they see as a worthy cause, which is building up the Country Music Hall of Fame. I don't think it's cynicism at all. I think that they thought that they were probably doing a good deed in entertaining soldiers. I mean, this is one thing that reoccurred many times in my story, is that there are personal connections between people in the country music industry and the military, right? Mm-hmm. So either they start out in country music and go to the military and come back out, or they start in the military and then once they get into civilian life, find their way into the country music industry in one way or another. So I don't think it's cynical at all. I think there's a real sense that they are doing their duty and just providing good entertainment. Now, of course, it's a business, right? As you suggest. So what's wrong with them making money off of that? Nothing in their eyes. And you know, I'll let the readers decide whether that's good or bad, but then I don't think it's cynicism at all. And that's something that I kind of struggled with in terms of pitching this book and even the title of it. I feel like people might look at it and say, aha, I knew there was this, like, you know, deep conspiracy to make, you know, Lee Greenwood. and what I found is that, no, you know, it's nothing so nefarious as that. It's something that grows rather organically over time and then becomes solidified as an institutional relationship.
Yeah, and I think that's usually how these things develop, right? It's rarely ever the conspiracy.
Sure.
There is a point, and you write a lot about this in the book, where during Vietnam, where country music takes on a far more political tone. And I think probably that one of the best examples that you write about, and certainly this was the song that I was most familiar with, is Merle Haggard's song, Okie from Muskogee.
Sure.
Which folks will probably know about it. But it really, well, tell us a little bit about that song and kind of it sort of stands out as an anthem. But you get into some really interesting stories about how that song was written and then the reaction to it when it's released.
Yeah, so if people aren't familiar with Okie from Muskogee, it's a Merle Haggard song that it's kind of held up as the quintessential backlash anthem, quote-unquote backlash. And backlash is kind of a catch-all term to talk about the white reaction to what many white conservatives saw as sort of the excesses of the Great Society, the excesses of the student movement against the war, the excesses of the civil rights movement. To many people, particularly conservative white Americans, it looked like America had come off the hinges in the 1960s. And so here's Merle Haggard's song that says, you know, we don't smoke marijuana in Muskogee. We don't burn our draft cards down at the courthouse. You know, we don't take our trips on LSD, etc. It's essentially celebrating the quote unquote square life, right? Which then becomes aligned with what President Nixon calls the silent majority. Those people who kind of dutifully go to their jobs, aren't protesting, their daughters are conforming to sort of normative gender expectations, their sons are as well, they're going to work in factories and or white collar jobs even, and they're going to fight in wars, right? They're not out there protesting. So this becomes this sort of backlash anthem. Of course, as many Merle Haggard fans will know, he wrote this as a sort of character study, along with his drummer in the band at the time. And, you know, is it poking fun at that? Or is it just sort of a poetic exercise, so to speak, of like, what would it mean to speak for these people in small town America like Muskogee, Oklahoma? He doesn't really even think about releasing it until it gets this big reaction at a performance on a military installation, and people hear it, and these service members hear it as speaking for them, right? Their frustrations with those protesters, their frustrations with the politicians that they think are sort of coddling these middle-class college kids who are out there protesting the war. Meanwhile, they're going off to die in Vietnam, potentially. And so here they have their hero. And so Merle Haggard releases that. It gets this big acceptance, kind of becomes championed by right-wing and conservative politicians. Most famously, Richard Nixon invites Merle Haggard to the White House to perform this. Richard Nixon is by no means a country music fan. He doesn't know, you know, Ferlin Husky from Roy Acuff. But the point is that Merle Haggard sees this as a sort of way that he can capture white working class sentiments. And so he holds up country music as this sort of weaponizes country music in a way for his own means.
And I just find it such a great story, because I always just presumed that Merle Haggard was, and I didn't know this, was writing from the heart, but he's kind of striking a pose. And I mean, you look at somebody like Merle Haggard in his later life, or even like Willie Nelson, who he's performed with, and like, these are not like paragons of squaredom.
You know? No, not at all. You know, there's a story that
Willie Nelson smokes a lot of weed.
Well, and as did Haggard. You know, he supposedly said that, you know, that Muskogee was the only place he didn't smoke marijuana in 1969. You know, so yeah, he's definitely one of those rebels of country music. And yeah. So yeah, it's odd for him to then be held up as this kind of spokesperson for this way of life that he himself did not practice.
So after the war, country music, it seems like, experiences more success in becoming mainstream, right? I mean, we get into the 70s, we get into the 80s. You have crossover artists like Dolly Parton, Kenny Rogers. Mm-hmm. I grew up in a house in Oregon with my parents listening to them, and Barbara Mandrell and Ronnie Millsap before we ever, and Olivia Newton-John, who would cross over, right? Before we ever moved to Nashville and like literally lived down the street from Dolly Parton. So like it clearly had permeated, you know, a big part of the national popular music consciousness. It's not, I don't know if it was ever really ghettoized, but it's becoming much more mainstream. And with that, you write that the popularity of the music among service members starts to decline. So talk about that point where it's almost as if it's peaked, and now we're entering a period where, you know, they don't have the PX stores locked down, and it's not, you know, the market penetration it used to be.
Yeah, country music kind of takes a hit in terms of its relationship with the military in the beginning in the late 70s and into the 80s for a few different reasons. One is the turn to the all-volunteer force. So Nixon ends the draft in 1973. This is a huge shift in military personnel policy for the United States. No longer is there this kind of threat of selective service hanging over young men's heads. So now there's this turn to volunteer enlistment. And because of that, the military begins to cast a wider net. We're also in a post-civil rights era, arguably, in the 1970s. And so, at least the mass movement phase. And so the Army is more willing to kind of cast a wider net in terms of its recruitment efforts. And when it does that, it starts creating like soul music programs, programs that specifically target African-American communities, which leads to the other big shift, which is the uptick in enlistment for African-Americans in particular. I would say racial minorities across the board, but African-Americans in particular, and women. Now, I'm not here to say that African-Americans don't listen to country music, right? Because that is obviously untrue. But the kind of perception, if we get in the heads of the people who are creating these recruitment programs, they're not thinking, hey, let's keep on the country music track because that will appeal to these new black recruits as well. No, they're saying we need to broaden our reach. We need to create these programs that could potentially help bring this pipeline in. And that's exactly what happened. So by 1980, a third of the U.S. Army are African Americans. That's a huge shift in numbers from that 1960s Army. And so because of that, because you do have a shifting demographics of the Army, country music is no longer as popular amongst those service members as it once was. And so by 1985, you have soul music or R&B that's actually the most popular genre amongst U.S. service members. And at the same time, there's a severe restructuring happening in the PX and on the AFRTS. And that is a kind of consolidation shift that's happening. So the PX starts consolidating how they ship records to these PXs. So there's no longer a kind of niche market supply going on. Instead, they begin to just ship over whatever the top 10 of that week is. And this makes it more efficient for them. They don't have to sort of respond to requests from individual PX stores about what inventory they want. They don't ask anymore, right? They just ship them what's popular, right? And so in this way, it sort of limits, even as there are more and more records being shipped out because the record industry is getting bigger. And as you suggest, country music is becoming more popular than ever at the time. But at the same time, it's fewer and fewer artists. So there's a kind of consolidation happening there. There's a similar story on the AFRTS. There were, going back to the 1950s and 60s, there were these kind of individual little locally hosted shows on Armed Forces Network stations. And those DJs could sort of pick and choose what they wanted to play. They could host live performances from other service members. Well, by the late 1970s, there's this need to restructure the AFRTS in order to save money. And when they do that, they shift over to automated radio programs, syndicated radio programs. Many of them are just kind of taken from civilian radio. So country top 40, think Casey Kasem's Countdown, except for country music, right? They just take that and put it on the air. So instead of having these local DJs who could sort of, again, cater to people's taste, push particular artists, it just becomes a kind of reflection of civilian listening on the AFRTS. And so that in that way, it begins to sort of water down the connection between the country music industry and the military.
Yeah, and then as we move from the late 70s into the 80s, the idea of country music as a sound of patriotism, which really is, this is coming from the title of your book, this is about to get a very, very big boost in the Reagan years. And there is one guy, you alluded to him a moment ago, who I think is kind of the symbol of this, and that is Lee Greenwood, who writes a song called God Bless the USA, which some people also know as Proud to Be an American. Mm-hmm. I did not know Lee Greenwood was a lounge singer in Vegas and was dealing cards in casinos before he ever became a country music icon. But tell us a little about Lee Greenwood and the event, which I also didn't know, which prompts him to write that song.
So a little bit about Lee Greenwood and his background. I have to say that I really kind of gained a newfound respect for Lee Greenwood when I was writing this, and I hope that comes through.
I think it does.
I'm not here to drag any of these artists or really to say that they're only in it for the money per se. In terms of kind of linking up with these ideas of patriotism. And I say I gained a new respect for Greenwood because I really didn't understand his story and his journey into country music. This is a guy who was kind of a child prodigy in terms of music, could play piano and saxophone really well, had a great singing voice, was by all accounts, you know, a really compelling performer, but kind of has a rough go of it and ends up sort of, you know, circling the drain sort of in Las Vegas, playing for casinos, as you said, dealing cards, and really doesn't have a lot of luck going for him. He strikes out a few big times. And he even says himself, you know, for a less determined person, this would have been, you know, they would have quit the music industry. And it's surprising to me that he didn't. But he does get a way into country music when Mel Tillis's bass player for a band called the Statesiders. That was Mel Tillis's band. And Mel Tillis has his own connection to the military that I'll let you folks read about. But the Statesiders bass player hears Lee Greenwood in a casino and says, hey, this guy's really got something. Gets him a deal in Nashville, and he launches into his country music career. Now, it's kind of country music slash adult contemporary, I think would be fair to call Greenwood's music, particularly his initial outings. Again, this is the early 80s, so Kenny Rogers is very big at this point. There's a lot of kind of crossover between adult contemporary and the sort of middle of the road album charts and country music at this point. But then, as you suggest, on September 1st, 1983, a Korean airliner gets shot down by the Soviets. And this enrages Greenwood. He feels as if war is imminent. And so he feels inspired to write this song, God Bless the USA, Proud to Be an American. And when he does so, the way that I think about it is a wartime song in search of a war. Because the United States does not respond the way that Greenwood expects them to respond. Because there were U.S. civilians on that plane, he thought that, you know, Reagan would come out with full retaliation. And that's just not what happened. So he's kind of stuck with this song that is very patriotic, right? It sounds like a wartime anthem. And there's no one to kind of there's no war for him to connect with.
And it's such a powerful song because, you know, it's the lyrics are very memorable. It's actually fairly easy to sing. I think it comes out in 1984. I was in grade school in, or was it middle school in Nashville. We sang that song in choir.
Oh, nice.
I mean, so it was like a thing that it was sort of like it was in the ether.
Sure.
And, you know, you write that it solidifies country music's reputation as the signature genre of U.S. patriotism. And I think that song seems like to me to kind of quintessentially sum up a lot of the thesis of the book, because that song, I mean, it gets adopted by, you know, political campaigns. Sure. It gets associated with, I think, largely conservative and more pro-military kind of forces. And where I really remember it coming really to fore, too, then is at the beginning of the Gulf War.
Absolutely.
Talk a bit about that and its emergence and the power of that song in the first Gulf War.
Yeah, so there is a definite connection between Greenwood and Republican politicians. Ronald Reagan really champions this song. Appears with Greenwood in public events and has him perform the song. And at the same time, you know, that kind of patriotic spirit can only take you so far if there is no war to kind of say rah-rah for. And so by the 1980s, Greenwood's career has started to sort of hit the skids a bit. But then here comes the first Gulf War. George H.W. Bush has already sort of used Greenwood on the campaign trail as someone who is, you know, out there to sing the patriotic songs and get the crowds fired up for the Bush campaign. And so then comes along Desert Storm. And yes, you see this kind of, you know, early 90s wave of patriotism. And I think we can go ahead and say, you know, jingoism, right, of this kind of hyper-patriotism. Us versus them, as it's going to get reanimated in the second Bush administration. But yeah, this is a real moment for Lee Greenwood. And the way I think of it is, now here is the war that he was finally, you know, waiting on and had written this song for. And so this becomes his kind of second wind in his career and really sets him up to become this voice of patriotism as many people imagine it being linked with country music. And, you know, it's not to say that I want people to understand is that he is not just coming out of the blue in this regard, that in fact, he is emblematic of this long career of country music and the military being hooked up since the 1950s. I think if we sort of take him in a vacuum of the 1980s or even the 1990s with Desert Storm, it can seem as if this patriotic spirit in country music just sort of bubbles up. Right. Or it somehow is linked back to that Vietnam era spirit. And that's a little too easy. Right. That's almost as if there's somehow this kind of genetic code in country music fans and artists that they are just predisposed somehow to patriotism. And that's not it at all. This is very much a longer story than that, a deeper story.
And, you know, and just to build on that point, too, and I think this is, you know, a point of evidence that confirms your theory there. You know, it's not as though when the Gulf War broke out that the only people, you know, making very big demonstrations of patriotism were country music singers. I mean, if anybody hasn't seen it, go look up Whitney Houston's yes. rendition of the national anthem at the Super Bowl in 1991.
With the flyover and
it'll knock your socks off. It's one of the most amazing performances I think she ever gave. It's incredible. But I mean, patriotism was breaking out everywhere, right? And I mean, the whole idea of support the troops, this is what comes up, you know, in a post-Vietnam era when the Gulf War begins. So it's not as though Lee Greenwood, you know, pricks some particular, like, you know, right wing, you know, middle to lower middle class, white Southern only vein of patriotism. And that's what everyone starts singing. It's happening everywhere. And
absolutely.
I mean, it's why today when we sing the national anthem, you know, at that seventh inning stretch or, you know, a lot of this is hangovers, not even from 9/11. It was back in the Gulf War that this kind of very conspicuous expression of patriotism came out, and it was happening with artists of all kinds. You know, I do wonder, though, I mean, because country music, and you wrote a whole book about this, is so associated with being very patriotic and pro-military. You even quote in the very beginning, Aaron Tippin is saying, we are the cheerleaders of the mm-hmm. military. Do you think that has made country music divisive among some audiences? Like, are there people who look at country music and say, I don't want to listen to that because that is propagandistic? or it's, I mean, I think if somebody even say it's racist, and we should say, quote, country music performers are overwhelmingly white.
Yes.
So does that, is there a sense in which that partnership with the military that goes back for so far and has been really helpful and productive for country music as industry, country music artists, has made the genre more polarizing?
Yeah, no question in my mind. That's key to understanding people's kind of taste divides when it comes to country music. It's one of those genres that gets dumped on quite a bit, particularly for people who maybe consider themselves really learned or have erudite taste in some way.
Right.
I like all kinds of music except country. Right. This is not an uncommon kind of expression of taste. And I think, part of that is this kind of association with this version of patriotism. And I want to say that very directly. When people critique country music for its association with the military, it's not to say that those people aren't patriotic, but there is a version of patriotism that is championed by country musicians and particularly the ones that I highlight in this book, right? That has to do with a sort of blind support for the military. And as that becomes a partisan issue unto itself, there's a way that country music's longstanding association with the military then forces it, sort of paints it into a partisan corner, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So even though, and this is something I hope comes out in the book, is that even though there are, individual artists with a wide array of political opinions about all kinds of issues, social issues, foreign policy, what have you, racial issues, country music is a very diverse community in that regard in terms of people's opinions. But that doesn't mean that industry represents that diversity, right?
Yeah.
So the industry, and here I'm really focusing on thinking about it as a business that's centered on Music Row and the CMA. They, because of their close association with the military, have kind of pushed country music into this corner in a way. So it's not reflective of the fans necessarily. It's not even necessarily reflective of the artist, but it is reflective of a particular business strategy that was pioneered here in the Cold War and has continued on in one way or another.
Do you think when contemporary artists like Luke Combs go and do a cover of Fast Car by Tracy Chapman, which upset some fans for other reasons, but then, they performed at the Grammys together and I think everyone loved it. Does that make the country music industry nervous when they see people kind of like breaking with maybe what we're thinking of as the mold here? Or do they look at that and say, no, this is great. Like more listeners, like let's get more people who never would have listened to country music, but will listen to it because somebody like Luke Combs, cuts a cover and performs with a beloved black artist from a different genre, and everybody seems to like that.
Yeah. Well, I'm not optimistic about the kind of racial future of country music, only because we've kind of seen this. I think the embrace of black artists in country music and by the country music industry is kind of cyclical and short-lived often, unfortunately. So you have your Charlie Pride in the late 60s into the 70s as one of the biggest artists of all times, right? You have these other moments in country music history. You have a Darius Rucker, right, who's able to make inroads.
AKA Hootie, yeah.
Yes, Hootie. able to make inroads at times, but does it really crack open the white dominance of that industry? And no, it hasn't.
Yeah.
Will Beyonce do it? I think is the the question now, right? And that's it's yet to be seen. There are great organizations like the Black Opry who people should check out. There are great musicians who have long championed the history of black artists in country music. Like Don Flemons or Rhiannon Giddens, who have said, Black people have always been a part of country music. And not only are they just influences, but they're actually some of the creators of country music, right? And that's true. And that's the story that we should be telling when it comes to racial diversity in the industry. And perhaps if we tell that more and more and more and enough, then more Black artists like Beyonce are making country records, then the industry may have no other option than to kind of broaden who counts as country. And so that's the optimistic look.
Yeah.
The pessimistic look is that it hasn't happened yet and people have been trying for a long time. And so that's the more kind of downer version of it. What I hope that I can bring to this conversation about racial diversity and country music is to say, the government and in fact, the U.S. military has a hand in creating this version of country music that we associate with a particular form of whiteness. And because of this connection and because of kind of conceptualizing the military, particularly the Cold War military before the rise of the ABF, the all-volunteer force, it was conceived of as a white institution. And there are racial problems, even as it's an integrated force, there are racial problems within our military that deserve more attention. And that is because it is this white dominated institution, its association with country music, which again, a very diverse genre full of African-American creators and influences, but yet in the kind of commercial sense of the genre has long been understood as the space of white artists and fans. So when you put those together, they become mutually reinforcing. And so if we think about, well, if we want to break open country music and really make it a more diverse space, part of the thing that I think we have to do is understand how it came to be understood as a white space to begin with. Mm-hmm. And I hope that my book is telling part of that story that hasn't been fully explored yet.
Yeah, I think it did. And it's a fascinating story that people are really going to enjoy reading more about. We only got to get into some of it here. Before we let you go, it's our tradition on Chatter. I reach into the Chatterbox, which I have here in my hand, and select a question that was pre-written. I select this at random.
Oh,
there are no country music questions in here, sadly.
Okay.
But I'll pull one out for you and ask this question. All right. Okay, this is good. This is, you're a writer, you're an historian. Who is someone in your field or a related one whose work more people should be following? And you could include a country artist or a musician that more people should listen to, too.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so in terms of in my field, there's a great writer and a colleague of mine on the country music circuit named Amanda Marie Martinez. I highly recommend people check out her work. She writes for NPR occasionally. She writes, she's written some great academic articles, and she's working on a book about how country music sort of moved from being a genre to a lifestyle brand. She's currently a postdoc at UNC, so I encourage people to check out Amanda's work. And in terms of country music that people should know more about, I'm going to go with O.B. McClinton.
Hmm.
He was a kind of key figure in my book. He actually doesn't get as much space as I thought he would. He's one of the places that I started researching this story. I was interested in him. For folks who don't know, which is probably many people, O.B. McClinton was a Black country music singer from Senatobia, Mississippi. He wrote R&B music before he became a country star. He discovered his talent for singing country music while serving in the United States Air Force on Okinawa. And that launched him into a country music career once he re-entered civilian life. Unfortunately, even though he was a highly talented man, he does not get the kind of respect that I think that he deserves as a pioneer in this way. And that kind of helps tie into my pessimistic take on race and country music at the moment, too. Maybe people will tune into some O.B. McClinton music and rediscover him.
I will go check him out. That sounds great. Well, Joseph Thompson, the book is Cold War Country, How Nashville's Music Row and the Pentagon Created the Sound of American Patriotism. This has been such a fascinating and great discussion. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for doing the book. And good luck as it rolls out.
Thank you so much, Shane. I really appreciate you taking the time to read the book and the thoughtful questions.
That was Chatter, a production of Lawfare and Goat Rodeo. Please subscribe to the podcast and find us on Twitter @ThatWasChatter.